Hello.
Hello, Nick.
Hi.
Hi, this is Daniel Williams. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Daniel?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. I just want to do a quick
sound check.
Yeah, sound check here and make sure all of our levels are up and we don't have to do this again. Looks like things are pretty good. How's things going up with you today?
Good. Good.
Got a lot of family
my
around?
Garden. And getting into spring, it just went from really cold to really warm suddenly.
Well, it's that's Mother Nature.
Oh, we're
for
doing
you.
A sound check, so I have to keep talking.
No,
right?
No, we're good to go. What I what I want to do, Nick, is you know I got this you know the sound check going. So what I'm going to do to introduce it, I'm just going to say, you know, welcome to a special edition of the Opium Den. We have Nick Sand on the line, and that'll be your cue that we've started the interview. So, if that works for you, that works for me.
And you're going to give me a series of questions.
Well, yeah, I want to start off with talking about the early days that you were out in California making orange sunshine, and just what the vibe was.
I'd like to go back a little bit further than that.
Sure, what would you like to do?
Because I started manufacturing in 62, and at that time, there was a complete different paradigm going. People still believed, you know, uniformly across the board in the system and were anxious to get involved in it. You could afford to go to school, and when you took psychedelics, it was not this foreboding terror that someone was going to kick in your door and arrest you. And so the Millbrook experience versus the California psychedelic experience, this is all before it was illegal, was such an incredible part of the set and setting change that occurred after criminalization of the psychedelics.
Well, hang on to that thought, and that's where we'll start. I've got my notes here that, you know, you went after college, you went to Millbrook with Timothy Leary. So you want to start there?
Well, during college, I went down and studied the psilocybin experience with Maria Sabinas in Oaxaca as part of you know, my own personal pursuit in the study that I was in, which was anthropology, cultural anthropology, and I went into cultural revitalization studies, and I began to realize there was a way to bridge all the cultures and all the different sets of beliefs by going inward and finding God.
Well, then let's start with there. Well, I'll open it up and I'll ask you
what happened when I came back. I ran into a chemist and he said, you know, you've got chemical background. Why don't we make some psychedelics? And I can go from there.
Okay, so we'll start off with how your interest came in psychedelics, and we'll let it go from there. Okay?
Perfect.
Okay, so I think we're all ready to go. So I'm going to pause for just a couple of seconds.
Yeah, and it's fine if you want to give broad questions, are fine. Just let's get the time frame starting at around the early 60s. And
you want to make your answers not too long.
Okay. All right. My guru is here in bed with me.
Oh, good.
That's my partner, Usha. Usha, say hello to Daniel.
Hi, Daniel.
Well, hello. What was your name again, please?
Usha,
how are you today, Lucia?
I'm fine. It's Usha.
Usha, I apologize.
But sometimes he can be quite long-winded. I don't know how much you have for this show.
I'm going to let him air it out as much as he'd like, Usha. This is a very important interview for me. I've got people that are just dying to hear, so I'm going to let Nick air it out and have whatever say he wants to have.
Great.
Super, great.
Okay, so let's pause for a minute and when I make my introductions, then you'll know we're ready to go. We're going to cut off all of this, obviously, this intro stuff when we play it tonight. But
yeah, of course. Okay. You have a very nice voice, by the way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Nick. And before we get started, I just want to tell you, you may not remember, but you met me in Basel at the conference. And we were sitting around the lobby of the hotel, and we were talking about our first LSD experiences. And I said that in the early summer of 1970, I took Orange Sunshine, and it was 250.
Oh, you're one of my kids.
Yes,
yeah.
I am. And I said, and
welcome, son.
Yeah, thank you, Daddy. Thank you. And I said it was 250 micrograms, And you leaned.
I went for like 20 years, never knowing if the orange sunshine thing had been any good, because it caused such a groundswell. It just destroyed my life, and I had to run for my life to Canada. And I never did know all those years that, you know, still making psychedelics and believing in my primary vision that it was going to have such an effect, but I never had any feedback. I was running like a rat with a redneck shooting shotguns at me, you know, in the wood pile.
Well, I can confirm that it was the best LSD I've ever done. I've been doing it still. And when I told the little group that was seated there, including you and some of the other luminaries in our business, and I said it was 250 micrograms, and you leaned across and patted me on the knee and said, "No, Danny, it was 300 micrograms." Because
I remember. I was saying, I met you. You know, I had just gotten out of a bad operation. Just like 2 or 3 weeks before I had lost my gallbladder and pancreatitis, but man, I was not going to miss Albert Hoffman's 100th birthday.
No, it was
my hero since the beginning.
It was a wonderful experience, and I think about it almost every day. I walk by. Missy and I had my wife and I had the good fortune to go to Albert's home in Switzerland and meet with him for a real long afternoon. And
oh, how cool!
It was very, yeah, it was very cool. It was very cool. Yeah. So I got a nice picture framed of me giving Albert a kiss on the cheek. So every time I walk by
cool. I have a picture of a DVD and the DVD of me presenting a crystal, an enlarged picture of a very beautiful crystal cluster of DMT base, which no one had ever made before. And I showed it to Albert, and he tapped on the glass of the picture very enthusiastically and said, "Send me this picture. Send me this picture. Do not fail." And he's got it. And until the day he died, he had it hung over his writing desk.
Yep. Well, I was in that little room where his writing desk was. He was looking for the piece of paper that Huxley's wife gave him. It was when Al just scribbled on a little piece of paper, 150 micrograms intramuscular, and he spent his last hours in bliss, and Albert spent about 10 minutes looking for that piece of paper, and he was so damn mad at himself that he couldn't find it. But we had a wonderful experience that day. It just was enlightening and so uplifting that, but we're wasting some good stuff here. So let's take a quick pause and just, you know, stay with me. I'm going to pause, and then I'm going to introduce you, and we'll get right into it.
Cool.
Okay. Here comes the pause. Nicholas Sand, good afternoon. Welcome to the Opium Den.
Thank you for having me, Daniel. Glad to be with you.
Well, I've got a lot of listeners out there that are pretty excited about hearing from what most people consider you to be the most legendary LSD chemist to ever make LSD. So I really appreciate you coming in. And How I'd like to start off, if you don't mind, I'd like you to take us back to when you first became aware and interested in psychedelics, and how that how you walked that path.
Well, okay, I guess we're going to have to go back to the early 60s. I was studying anthropology at Brooklyn College, and I had become fascinated by cultural revitalization movements. This is when a culture has been destroyed by another culture, say the white man coming and destroying the American Indian cultures, that caused an uprising of the use of peyote, which managed to allow them to rid themselves of white man's sickness and alcoholism, and to cure their inability to function by combining the cultural values of both their native indigenous values and the maturation stages of growing up with the American white one, which had impinged and basically destroyed their cultures. But peyote managed to allow them to bridge that gap and find new integration. So I found this really fascinating. And then speaking to Tim one day, he said, oh, you know, there's this woman down in Oaxaca.
Now, Tim, and, you mean Tim Leary or Tim Scully?
Pardon?
I didn't mean Tim Leary, actually. Tim Leary, okay.
And so I decided on my own to take a group, and we went down and we studied and were initiated by Maria Sabinas of the Mazatec Indians in the use of the psilocybin mushroom. And that was a very enlightening experience for me. I had, my first thing had been mescaline, and I did it according to the rituals of the Kiowa Indians. And I needed some sort of framework. And it was after these two experiences, which had been, the mescaline trip was an amazing trip for me. I sat the whole night nude in the lotus position, looking into the fire, feeling my chakras sending lotuses into the fire, which exploded into all of the vast potentials I had in each center of my being. And this was such a transcendent experience. It caused me to take off a year just to integrate it all, because I realized I'd gone from someone who had very low self-esteem to someone who realized there was nothing I couldn't do if I applied myself with positive energy. So this was a real breakthrough. So I went and studied with Maria and had more breakthroughs and more realizations. And when I came back, I decided to be at the encouragement of a guy working at a chemical company as a lab tech that we should make some psilocybin. Well, that was an extremely ambitious project, which failed. But in the process, the analogous procedure for making dimethyltryptamine, DMT, was the same up to the last step where I had failed. So by simply switching starting materials, I was able to make a whole lot of DMT, and I started turning people on to DMT, which was changing a lot of people's lives around. And then one night I went to attend a lecture with Richard Alpert, now Ram Dass, living in Hawaii, good friend of mine for over 40 years. After the lecture, a group of us went up to, you know, chat with him further, ask questions and so on. And the third group thinned out, and eventually there was only me and a lab tech left. I was manufacturing DMT in the basement of my mom's house at the time. And I took Richard home, and I showed him my little lab, and I showed him what I was studying, and how I was very inspired by DMT, which was also giving me one life-transforming realization after another. So he said, why don't you come up to Millbrook? And I said, I'd love to come up to Millbrook.
Now, tell everybody who Millbrook, or what Millbrook was. They may not understand, right?
Right. Okay. Well, when Richard Alpert, now called Ram Dass, and Timothy Leary were professors at Harvard, they entered into a series of experiments with psilocybin. And they formed a group in Newton Center, Massachusetts. But then they got fired from Harvard, and they decided to move, and they were given a gracious refuge by Billy Hitchcock, who was the snitch in my Sunshine trial. But he was, up to that time, a good friend of mine and one of my tripping buddies. I began to be introduced to the concepts of set and setting. And this is the thing, mostly, that I would really like to talk about. Now, Millbrook was a large house on a mansion, and many people came there, celebrities, authors, editors, even a few politicians came through, and it was our joy to turn them on in a guided session with the proper accoutrements, sound of running water, fish swimming, something over 500 years old. It's in a poem that Timothy wrote called During the Session. And so the set and setting concept was really developed and refined to a very high degree at Millbrook, which was a psychedelic center, which became the home of the Castalia Foundation and the League for Spiritual Discovery, which was an incorporated religion. And we thought we were protected because of the First Amendment rights that allows us to worship in any way we want. And to our chagrin, a few years later, we found out that no, we didn't have those rights, and that we were being turned into criminals. But during this time, there was no fear of being arrested because nothing we were doing was illegal, neither the manufacture, the distribution, the turning on, or the use or possession. So set and setting is such an important part. Now, set is what you bring to the session, your feelings at the moment. So if you're going to create a good set, it's good not to eat heavily before a meal. It's not have a meal before the session. If you're robust physique, probably good to fast a day or two, completely just drink water. You'll get the most out of your session that way. Setting is the environment. And at that time, the environment at Millbrook was a beautiful 2600 estate in a 70-room mansion. It was built around the turn of the century. It was gorgeous. And surrounded by hundreds of acres, thousands of acres of forest and lakes and rivers, was an ideal set and setting. Similar to Albert's vision of having a place with lakes and swans and temples where people could be initiated in a paradisical world. So the set and setting is really critical. You know, we found that if we could make the setting beautiful with flowers and everybody clean and dressed and prepared for the trip, that it was much better. The setting, the aesthetics and beauty with which you surround yourself before the trip, and is often more difficult in a traditional home. So many people have resorted to going out into the wild and relating to nature directly, which is another way of creating, you know, a beautiful setting. But this all changed in 65 and 66. And I began to notice at the psychedelic gatherings that people were taking, like, barbiturates and wine, and people weren't dancing anymore. The joy of freaking freely in the California Dionysian scene became very muted. And the effect of psychedelics is that they are so sensitizing to everything that's in you. They put you in touch with your DNA. They put you in touch with the cosmos. Then to have this terror that someone's going to kick in your door, knock you down, chain you up, and drag you away for having a religious experience really changed the entire ambience of the United States at this time, because there was no way to turn on anymore without knowing back in your mind somewhere that you're now a criminal doing this. And so our religious freedoms were, we were relieved of our religious freedoms at this time. And as a result, millions of people have been prosecuted and tortured and put into jail over the last 40 years of this drug war.
And you, you being a prominent one who was arrested and thrown into jail. Well, moving from Millbrook, where did your mind and experience take you from Millbrook? Where did you go next?
Well, there was a very beautiful girl at Millbrook and someone who came from California who was living on a 300-acre ranch. And we moved there, and I had my child there. And this was in California, Northern California, in Cloverdale, and we formed one of the first psychedelic communes, and we were all into going back to the land and to feel nature and to form a family tribal unit that could share the psychedelic experience. So that's what I did, and I ran into Owsley at Millbrook, and he invited me also, and he became a strong critic of the purity of my psychedelic sacraments and gave me a few verbal boots in the ass about it. And so I endeavored to produce something that was finer than even pharmaceutical grade. And I succeeded, and that's why the onset of the LSD that I made is always so smooth. Not always, because some people don't have the right set and setting, but if they do, it is very smooth, because LSD is a magnifying intensifier. And so if there are other impurities in it, even though they wouldn't normally have any effect on you, you can see them under this microscope and macroscope that you experienced during the LSD experience. So LSD not made in Owsley's tradition and in Tim Scully's tradition of making absolutely pure, double recrystallized, chromatographed LSD, if you don't have that, you will have a good experience probably, but it won't be as good and it won't be as smooth, but it will still work.
Well, Orange Sunshine was the first LSD that I ever took back in the early summer of 1970, and I must agree with everyone else that I've ever met that took the drug back then in that time, was that Orange Sunshine was the most pure and the best LSD I've ever taken, and it still remains in the minds of many as the very best LSD ever produced. So thank you for me and probably millions of others who experienced such a pure pharmaceutical grade of LSD. Did you get a lot of feedback at the time with regards to what you were making, or were you just too busy?
Well, yes, busy running the commune, busy running underground laboratories, which are very elaborately, you know, because of the security and, you know, the observation of any place where you can source equipment or chemicals. So we had to stage these almost like quasi or paramilitary operations, you know, like little spy units, little groups that would go out. But what happened was that when the Orange Sunshine came out, and it was a whacking good dose, and it has been verified to me personally by one of the head forensic chemists of the DEA, that he was amazed that when he analyzed my LSD, the Orange Sunshine, at every tablet he analyzed had precisely 300 micrograms. Pharmaceutical tableting and stuff has a 1 to 10% variation that's allowable. So this was even better than pharmaceutical grade. But the groundswell that occurred from the release of that LSD that Tim and I made, Tim Scully, who was my partner in the Orange Sunshine Project, was so powerful. It caused such a tsunami from Washington, became very frightened at a force that could stop the Vietnam War in its tracks, to which I think Orange Sunshine did play a role.
Yes, it did.
Was so disrupting. It destroyed our commune. They stole our land. We had all worked very hard, and over the years we had saved up enough money, but everybody was so terrified they couldn't come forward. So I took the rap, and using tax evasion things like they did with Al Capone, they managed to wrangle, you know, a 15-year sentence for me in front of a judge, you know, was appointed to spearhead the war on drugs. And I didn't get any feedback. I had to run. I was arrested with five shotguns to my head. I'm a total pacifist. I've been a yogi since I've been 15, and this whole thing was so bizarre and Kafkaesque that it was all happening to me, and there I was being taken from one venue to another in chains and shackles, and you know, it's basically torture. They want you to cop a plea, and they will torture you until they get one from you, and you have the worst facilities as long as you're fighting your case, and it prolongs the time in jail, which is extremely uncomfortable. It's meant for short-term, you know, processing, but usually winds up, you know, being years and years of torture. So many people broke. I fought my case to the bitter end. I did not want to give in to that whole thing. And I finally got out on appeal bond after being sentenced to 15 years. At this time, I had a choice to make. I had a young daughter who I was completely in love with, and I decided that I could not be separated from my daughter. I was already teaching her at home to read and write and all of this, and she was the joy of my life, and I said, I am not going to lose this, and I took her and my wife, and we fled to Canada, where we joined a network of peace activists, draft dodgers, and drug fugitives, mainly psychedelic and marijuana. And that's where we lived for 20 years, using false ID that was, you know, very well made. And we went all over the world. I went to India. I lived in ashrams and studied yoga and meditation. So by the time I got back to Canada and started a new laboratory, I still had no idea. It wasn't until I appeared in front of the Mind States in Berkeley that I realized how many people came up to me and said, you have changed my whole life. I've been wanting to meet you for 20 or 30 years. And, of course, this was amazing to me. This was in 2001. So this was the 2001 Mind States. I think it was in May, late May. And so after I made that appearance, really it was like since 1970 till 2001, I had no idea the effects of what I had doing. I did it sheerly on my own personal experience and how important it became to me through all of my visions that everybody must get stoned, as Dylan used to say, and that it's a really good thing at least once in your life to take a look into, you know, your inner self and see that listening to everybody above you, around you, is okay for surviving. But if you want to have a deep spiritual experience and know God, you must look within, because it doesn't exist but inside of you.
That's exactly right. Those are my sentiments. Share with me and our listeners the lab that you put together in Canada and how you eventually were found out and arrested there and then extradited back to the U.S.
Well, when I was in Canada, someone came up to me. And they said, you know, a few people found out who I was and what I could do. And I just basically was living, mining a little gold and farming up in northern Canada, living a peaceful life. And they prevailed upon me to open a laboratory and teach them to make psychedelics, which I agreed to do. And we got it together, and we did it, and we produced very fine MDMA, DMT, LSD, and eventually we were arrested through the cowardice of another psychedelic chemist named Leonard Enos, who now works for the DEA. So that was very disappointing. The laboratory was extremely beautiful. We really, it was a work of love, and it worked perfectly. And we produced superfine sacraments for people to take. A lot of ecstasy, a lot of pure ecstasy, better than pharmaceutical grade. And I was arrested, and then I was taken back. The laboratory was one of the finest laboratories that had ever been discovered, and it was so fine a laboratory that the Health Canada official in charge of the taking down of the laboratory said that they didn't have anything like this anywhere in Canada, not even in their own RCMP and laboratories in Ottawa. And he was very impressed with what we had. And so they made a full-length video of it, which I've got a copy of. It's kind of depressing, you know, to see them, you know, destroy something. They didn't really destroy it, but they just made a movie of what was there. And so, but the atmosphere, of course, it's very sad, you know, very terrorizing. Many people of our groups who have seen this say, I don't want to see that again. It's just too depressing. But there's a full screen version of a full-length film of the laboratory being entered and filmed. So that does exist. But I think one of the things I would like to say about MDMA, which we haven't hit yet, is that I think it's very important. And I think that LSD, you know, in the deconstruction of a paradigm that is beginning to be dysfunctional, such as the United States policies and hypocrisies, that you need to start to deconstruct the mental set that you've been programmed with. LSD is about deconditioning, and all the psychedelics are about deconditioning and superseding all of the programs that we reflexively react to everything. We can't say certain words with certain letters. Like if you say the F word, that's really so far cry from what you could do if you could just get out of all that. And that's what we were doing, getting out of the constraints of the mental programming that we had been subjected to, and which is still, of course, going on with, you know, like on steroids. But no one was really ready, because we did make a batch of MDA, which is a little rougher than MDMA, but it's still a love hug drug and one where people can relate very intimately with each other. And our commune at that time was looking, they had just restricted the starter materials on all levels for making LSD. So we were waiting to make underground connections to get, you know, our starter materials. And in the meantime, we tried to make other things which were legal to get around the criminalization aspect. And we made some MDA, and we took it. And I was like, well, it's kind of nice, love hug drug, only lasts 4 hours, and we had sort of been preconditioned to expect a 12-hour trip. But I don't think we were ready for it. I think that 20 or 30 years after the LSD experience, population was now ready to go to a deeper level, because all thoughts really originate from feelings, and feelings are more powerful than thoughts. So after we had, you know, culturally deconstructed bit by bit through the changes that have been happening in the last 40 years, in the 80s, suddenly MDMA was rediscovered, which was a great mystery. Why did MDMA suddenly become so relevant and so important? And it was because we all need love. And all the youngsters that take it should also realize that set and setting with MDMA is also very important. And again, I'm not going to go to this division, the East Coast, Apollonian, everything must be very strict and religious and do everything. That does produce a very beautiful visionary trip. But there's also a way to dance to God, to walk into the fields and make love and all of that. And that's sort of more the Dionysian take. Well, I think you need both. And I think we need bridges to both. And I think the psychedelics such as mescaline, psilocybin, and LSD are the ones that are more mental. And MDA and MDMA are the ones that activate the heart. And it's so important for the youth and the young people taking it to understand that this is a sacrament, and you can have way better trips by doing it in a sacred and private situation instead of at parties where people are drinking booze and stuff like that. That, to me, is kind of sacrilegious.
Oh, I agree with you. That is sacrilegious to mix alcohol or even, you know, other drugs, barbiturates, amphetamines, with either LSD or any of the psychedelics, MDMA. To mix chemicals is not a very good thing. But what I don't want to bring you down, so to speak, but I would like our listeners to hear about your trials and tribulations once you were extradited back to the United States and where you stood trial and were put in jail. So give us your thoughts on how all that went down and who betrayed you and how you came through it all. Because like I said, when I met you in Basel, Switzerland, you were just the sweetest, nicest man I'd ever met. And to know that you had been through such a hassle gave me hope that others can do the same thing. So give us your view on your prison time and how all that came to pass.
Well, the prison time was actually rather interesting. It happened in two phases. The first was when I was arrested. I had a very beautiful laboratory in St. Louis, and I was arrested there. And in 1974. Yep. So at the end of 73, I think it was at the beginning, January 74, I was arrested in Missouri. I was held there for a while. They hadn't done the arrest correctly, and the case was thrown out for my laboratories in St. Louis. So I was then transported to California and chained and shackled and driven on sometimes flown to San Francisco, where I was put into the San Francisco County Jail. Now, the San Francisco County Jail is a pretty rough jail, and for a city that likes to consider itself enlightened, it is a really cancerous ulcer on the morality of the people that allow such a system to go on. I witnessed guards taking out mentally sick people and practicing karate on them, and I actually got two guards fired for doing that because my lawyer was very close with Hengisto, who was the sheriff, and I told him what happened and, you know, why the guy wound up in the hospital. And he transmitted to Hengisto, and those guards were fired. So I did a little good there, and I eventually avoided being raped, beaten, and everything by the people, you know, who have been disenfranchised from, you know, the wealth of our society and have become thieves and whatever, you know, all the people you find in jail. At that time, there were very few people in for drugs. It was mainly in, like, robbers and people who beat people up and murderers and things like that. So that was a really heavy experience. It was very depressing. It was very scary. And eventually I got out of the tanks and became a trustee because they needed someone smart enough to, you know, to run the control center, because the guards couldn't really deal with it. It was not computerized at that time, or little bits. So the jail experience was pretty heavy, and but I learned a lot there. And as soon as I was convicted, they sent me up to McNeil Island. And McNeil Island was, I believe it was built by the same architect who did Alcatraz, which is such an eyesore and such a shame to San Francisco that they had to shut it down. So they put me up into one just like it, located in a fog-bound Puget Sound, in a place where prisoners were, you know, routinely killing themselves. As I was booked into the prison, they were dragging body bags out for people who had committed suicide from being in the hole too long. And a whole lot of stuff was going on then that is still going on, you know, at an accelerated rate. I mean, it's probably tens of millions of people just for marijuana have gone through this system in the last 40, 50 years. And that's just criminal. I mean, people using marijuana is just, it's crazy. How can you make a plant illegal? So, personally, in that phase, I did not do very well, to be frank with you. I managed to survive. I managed to get out. I became an operating room technician, working during surgery with visiting surgeons to the prison. And then I continued to do that when I got out on appeal bond. But when it came time for the appeal, it was denied. And I didn't have any confidence that I would get any relief from the Supreme Court of the United States. So I just quietly vanished, and it was quite exciting time. I was living in a houseboat in Sausalito, pretty much just waiting to see which way the cookie was going to crumble. And Nikki Scully came over, and she said, "We got to get you out of here. Your appeal's been denied." So she drove me to another friend. And that friend took me to Oregon, where I met another friend from prison, and I hid out there until I got enough ID to cross into Canada. I made it into Canada, no problem, and I started to live in Canada until I went. And when I established my Canadian ID, I then went to India, where I studied meditation and worked in an ashram for 3 years, and then I returned to Canada, and I continued with the same master in Oregon. And then when that commune broke up in 81, I went back up and did a variety of things, farming, beekeeping, gold mining, just being in nature and keeping my head down, until again I came to the part where I made the laboratories in the when was it, 93, 94, 95, 96, and was arrested on September 28, 1996, held there until we worked out all the details of being transferred back into the United States, at which time I was held in the same jail that I'd been in San Francisco County Jail, for 5 months till my trial for bail jumping was where they managed to get the same hanging judge to do my case. And so we went for a bench trial instead of a jury trial, because it was a technical issue and he had not done the procedure correctly. So Conti, the judge, was overruled 3-0 by a varied panel on the Ninth Circuit, which allowed me to get bail. This whole process took a couple of years, during which time I was transferred from one jail to another, and then finally to Terminal Island, and then from there to Lompoc. During this time of incarceration, and arrests. I think I counted 73 bed changes, 14 different institutions, and being black box chained, shackled, belly chained, handcuffed, and made to travel that way for days and days. It's extremely difficult to go to the bathroom like that. So the whole system is, you know, based on torture. They make no distinction between someone who got caught smoking a joint or someone who just, you know, murdered 10 babies. I mean, they treat you all the same. And there's no distinction. You're just basically tortured.
Now, when did you get out of prison for the last time? And obviously you've stayed out, but when did you get out of prison, and what did you do?
Well, I mean, basically, when I think I need to go back a little bit further. So eventually I was transferred to Terminal Island, and in Terminal Island, I had a choice. I could be miserable, or I could turn it by mental intention into a yoga camp. And everybody said, oh, you're not going to be able to do that. You're going to have to, you know, hook up with some gang because someone's going to have to protect you in prison. I said, I don't think so. So I got one of those 20-minute, you know, day jobs eventually after taking care of the roses, which I liked doing very much. And then I went and worked as an orderly in one of their units, and I walked 5 miles every day. I did 2.5 hours of yoga and meditation, and I wrote. I wrote a book, a manual on how to use psychedelics. I wrote articles on different trip experiences, and I was successful in not letting the prison experience really bring me down. Now, of course, the food is out of date and of very low quality and not very nourishing, so my health did begin to deteriorate a bit from that. I've recovered by now. So I think I did the jail experience a second time way better, you know, using the lessons from the psychedelics about setting, but at this time, even a more advanced concept, that is intention. How you can set your intention in your life to be joyous, to be open-handed, or to be closed-fist, uptight, and miserable. And we all have this choice every day when we wake up, misery or joy, misery or joy. And some people say, well, I want to be real, and I'm miserable. But misery and joy on a certain level of consciousness are both illusory. So if you put on the joyous mask for a while, sometimes it becomes second nature and becomes natural. If you put the misery mask on, the same thing occurs. So you really have a simple choice. I stayed in prison until December 20th, 2000. And at this time, everyone said, don't expect to get parole. You're old law, but you're not going to get it because nobody got it. But my behavior was so exemplary. I got complimentary release, early termination from Washington, at which time I started working in a jewelry store, started editing my book, and just living a life with... Yeah, then I went to the halfway house. That's right. When I got out of prison on the 20th of December, my term was still not up, and the halfway house I stayed in for about 4 months, and I was not allowed to sleep anywhere else. But then after a while, they started giving me weekends at home with Rusha, and then they gave me home confinement. And it was during this period of transition to so-called normal society that I was invited to speak at the Mind States. And it was at that time that I had this incredible just shock stand in front of 600 people that the producer said he had never seen anyone get a standing ovation from everyone from the talk I gave. I still have copies of that talk, should anyone want them. Eventually, I'm going to organize a website and put it all up there for everyone to read. Just haven't gotten to it yet. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does, and I think it it answers it very well. So tell us, I've got a couple more other questions here, but I'd like you to tell us what you've been doing since 2000. What has the last 9 years of Nick Sands' life been like?
It's been very, very, very beautiful. Usha waited for me for years and years while I was in prison, and we wrote dozens and dozens of, you know, many-paged letters where we worked out, you know, our love. And when I got out, we began to live a life together here in California, doing organic gardening. I was working in a jewelry store for years till I retired. And just been, California is a very beautiful place. And we live in a gorgeous little spot in the woods. And it's just been very peaceful, lots of yoga, meditation, walking in the hills, and being in love.
Well, being in love is the greatest thing any one person can do with another. And take us back just a little bit. Tell us, you know, there's been a lot of controversy about Timothy Leary, whether he, you know, whether he screwed the pooch on LSD, was good for the was good for LSD or bad. What's your opinion of Timothy Leary, and how do you think his legacy should be written?
Well, okay. Timothy Leary comes from you know, an older paradigm, baseball and beer. And his contact with psilocybin, you know, was very revelatory. But the enculturated values that he had were, you know, so strong from this older paradigm that, and he was an intellectual. He was not a spiritualist. See, this is the difference between him and other people, like Ram Dass, who, you know, it became a spiritual journey for him that then brought him to India and Nim Karoli Baba, where he studied meditation. So there were two ways to go. But Timothy was brilliant, absolutely brilliant, quicksilver mind. And one of his great psychological techniques was to invent these slogans that had incredible effects on people. And so it worked very well. I mean, he would be going out and saying, tune in, turn on, and drop out, you know, which basically means hear the DNA singing in your blood. Drop out of restricted life where there's no love and there are bad choices that are the only ones that are presented to you. And do this by turning on. And so, in a way, he and I were a team, even though he and I really didn't get along that well. I still loved and respected him. And I think his legacy should be remembered as the man who was the snake oil salesman. He's the guy who went out and said, we have a cure-all here, and I want everybody to hear about it. So it was Timothy's work as the publicist and the philosopher for LSD and turning on the youth. Without his work, there would have been much less interest in it. And you know, when I was introduced in Basel, the man who introduced me said, there are two people at this conference who have really turned on the world. One is Albert Hoffman, and the other is Nick Sand. And even though I was not invited to speak in Basel, he gave me his spot and allowed me to tell my story. That was Bob Horty,
right.
Who's a good friend and a very generous person who I just barely met at the time, who felt I think in many ways the same way you do. So where would you like to go?
Well, so your belief that Timothy Leary's legacy should be that he was the publicist and the Pied Piper, for lack of a better term, and that on balance, what he did was good?
I don't really think in terms of good and bad. I do think that psychedelics are good. Everyone makes mistakes. We're all experimenting if we're living life, and we learn by our mistakes. We all learn by our mistakes, and those mistakes were very important and nothing to feel bad about. People make mistakes, and they should not condemn themselves for it. They should love themselves and realize that the mistake is showing them a new way to do things that's better, and often is the beginning of an invention. So Timothy really was the person that spread the idea of turning on to the whole world, while the intellectuals and the medical profession were threatened and disappointed, because his popularization led to many changes in the basic culture, which then brought the government in and restricted all LSD research. So naturally, these researchers were very frustrated, and they had to change their entire tactics, and they too had to go underground if they were going to continue using LSD and other psychedelics as psychotherapists. So it's been a long hiatus since the time when psychedelics could be used for, legally for research, till now, when it's just starting to occur again. And I think that what Timothy was getting at was self-realization. And that is what it's all been about for me, too. Self-realization and the sharing of the love, the sharing of the light, which is, a side effect of having a positive experience on any of the psychedelics or pathogens. So his role was very important. And I think his role was to support the spiritual umbrella over which all these other little disciplines like psychology, psychiatry, harm reduction, all this kind of stuff wants to say, well, we're going to do it legally, we're going to do it right, and it's going to be done according to government regulations. And right there, it kind of like will destroy your set and setting. But we're managing. And I'm in touch with all the people that are using psychedelics legally, and their work is excellent. But I think we have to keep in mind the medical model is superseded by the transcendent spiritual model, which is the deepest level that you can go to in life and should not have the restrictions of the medical model.
That is very well put, Nick. That's exactly my thoughts on the issue, and I couldn't have said it any better. I do a lot of I give a lot of lectures on college campuses about drugs and drug policy, and I'm encouraged by one, the responsibility of young people and wanting to know exactly what it is that they're ingesting into their systems. But I have found, to my surprise and comfort, that there is a still a very tremendous interest in psychedelics, specifically LSD, and there's a lot of mushrooms being consumed. So always a great interest, and they love to hear about Albert Hoffman and people like you that were responsible for allowing them to discover their inner beauty and stretch their minds. What I have found, though, I'd like to get your comments on this. Over the past maybe 10 or 15 years, what the LSD that I've been able to find seems to be of a much smaller dose level than the original days of Orange Sunshine, White Lightning, and some of the others. Do you sense that, or is that just something that's just an anomaly for my search? Or do you think that the LSD experiences that people are having today with the lower dose levels are somehow less satisfying or less enlightening than in the early days when 300 micrograms would literally blow your mind and you would see God and commune with nature. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, in part, I think I'm responsible for it. And in part, I think it has to do with the terrorism of the war on drugs and on the people it's supposed to protect. And when I was in Canada, I realized, you know, the incredible tsunami I had started with 300 mics, because in those days, people really didn't know about set and setting. I think they know more about it now. And I think they could handle higher doses. But at that time, I was concerned for, you know, my personal safety. And I decided, well, let's just tell everybody what it is, how much it is, and if they want to get to 100 mic level, take one square, or we're making it on a blotter then, or take two squares if you want to have a really nice trip where the hallucinations begin, and three if you want to see God. And so we began to manufacture it in 100 mic doses. And that, you know, went very well. And when the RCMP interviewed me, I said to them that do you have any idea how much LSD has gone out into the Vancouver area? And they said, no. And I said, you have access to all the data that comes from drug abuse cases and medical emergencies in the emergency rooms, and you're up with that, aren't you? Because I was talking to major investigator and a Health Canada official. And they said, yes, we know very well. And I said, okay, how many casualties from LSD use have you observed in the emergency room reports? And they said, none. And I said, do you know how many doses of LSD I produced here in Vancouver and distributed here? And they said, no. I said, 10 million. They were flabbergasted. They said, well, it must have gone somewhere else. It couldn't have been here. And I said, no, it didn't. Most of it did get here. Some went to Montreal, but mainly it was all consumed right here in Vancouver. I would not allow anyone to take it to the U.S. because I was afraid to, knock on that door. So I didn't allow it to go to the U.S. I just distributed it in Vancouver, and it caused, a great deal of enlightenment in the general population there.
Do you think that... Go ahead.
I'm going on a little bit further here. But yeah. What has happened is it's become more and more and more difficult to get decent starting materials, decent equipment, and decent chemicals. The restrictions have become so tight that people get whatever they can from whatever they can, and they make batches of stuff. They're so running and hiding doing this kind of manufacture that they don't have the inspiration, they don't have the knowledge, they don't have the understanding anymore of how important a really pure psychedelic is. So not only have the dosages become, in many cases, disco dosages, I think Arrowhead and some of the other sites who have analyzed average doses were saying they were between 25 and 50. So, and it's probably not a high-quality LSD. It is LSD, but it's a very low dose. So what people do to compensate for that is they take a strip of them, five or ten at a time,
right,
and they have good trips. A little rougher than if the LSD were made with, great care and double recrystallized and all that. But that is sort of how the dosage levels evolved. The terrorism is responsible for it, and the government is responsible for all of the drug tragedies that occur, because criminalization is insane, and all it's doing is bankrupting our country, and it's not working, and everyone agrees the war on drugs is not working, yet it persists. So this is just, a typical insanity that we live with among all the other insanities.
Well, do you think that we'll ever get back to a situation where much higher quality and higher microgram dose levels will be produced. And what you said about the impurities and not quite as good as the old days, I guess. And I've noticed that too. The transition seems to be just a little rougher, a little less smooth than some of the original acid back in our time, I guess. So do you see potential? Do you see that changing, or is that just going to be the way it is?
Well, when I go to the psychedelic gatherings to give talks and stuff like that, I hear that there are many interested college students who can understand these concepts. And when I was manufacturing LSD, it was an extremely complicated procedure until some more simple procedures were invented and discovered and found to be relevant. So I think people are starting to understand the importance of this, the difficulty of, you know, manufacturing pure psychedelics in a terrorist society is extremely difficult. And so mistakes are made, shortcuts are taken that shouldn't be taken, that are, in my view, unethical. But you know, when you're a rat, you know, being chased by a bunch of rednecks shooting shotgun blasts at you in a woodpile, sometimes, you know, you can't pick up every little stick. And you got to pick up every little stick to produce a fine psychedelic. But it's very difficult in these conditions. As though you want to produce a fine wine, but, you know, the government is spraying the lands, they're running highways through your orchards, power lines over. Well, you can't produce a good wine that way, and you can't produce a good psychedelic under those circumstances either. So, yes, I am hoping that there will be a groundswell of interest. And the information is available everywhere. Pical, Tikal, has all the newest formulas, and they all work. And I think and feel that on a groundswell level, because it never goes top down. It's always from bottom up where change occurs, because we are the base of the pyramid of power. We are the ones that support it. And as soon as we can get out of the conditioning of supporting this pyramid of oppression and spiritual restriction, the pyramid will come down and we can form something new where we can start treating this planet like the paradise it is, and develop our DNA to the point where we can use it not as some kind of strange genetically modified thing, but as a way of evolving to higher levels. Well, I think this change is occurring. I'm sure it's occurring. We're going to go through a bad patch this year, for sure, at least, and maybe a few more. But, you know, you can't make omelets without breaking eggs, and I just would recommend everybody hold on, meditate, and do whatever you can to keep your sanity, because it is through fear that people are controlled. And if you want to be free, you have to find the source of your fear, go into it, accept it, love it, and transcend it.
Well, that's very true. And along those lines, what, as far as the future for not only psychedelics but for drug policy in general, do you think that there is any reason to be hopeful with Barack Obama as president?
Well, I'm a little skeptical about Barack Obama. He just appeared out of nowhere and suddenly became a senator, and then suddenly he's been, it's sort of like he's been just, well, let's pick this one, polish him up, you know, pretty him up, and put him forward and look like we're, you know, the first country who's elected a black leader out of a white population. And but the fact that 14 of his cabinet members are trilateral commission members, and the fact that he's still talking about sending 400,000 troops to Afghanistan, you know, which is a war of invasion and will always initiate guerrilla warfare. It's always a matter of, you know, how long it will be before the invaders are either acculturated into that land or driven out. I mean, no one has ever held Afghanistan for very long.
Yeah, the Afghanis have a hard time doing it.
No, I'm not really happy with what I'm hearing from Barack Obama, but if he does manage to keep his election promise of decriminalizing marijuana, I would say that's a positive step. But it hasn't happened yet. And the FBI figures for marijuana arrests since 2003 to 2007, I think was the last ones Normal reported on, and it's been like gone like 450,000 2003 to 525,000 to 600,000.
Yeah, we just had our 20 millionth arrest
marijuana arrest per year as of, I think it was 2007.
Right.
So even though there are states legalizing medical marijuana and stuff like that, and this is, of course, you know, non-carcinogenic, non-harmful, been proven 6 ways to Sunday to be absolutely benign medicine, and it's still illegal. And he could have, in one moment, signed an executive order legalizing or decriminalizing marijuana and forbidding any judge anywhere to throw someone in jail for marijuana. He hasn't done it. And it was one of his campaign promises. So am I thrilled by Barack Obama? No, not yet. If he does something besides continue, you know, backing all the war material manufacturers, I mean, the United States lives off of war manufacture. The amount of war material we produce is twice as much as all the combined military spending of every other nation in the world.
Yeah, I just read in the Wall Street Journal the other day that the total, just the cost overruns, the money that we pay on top of what we've been paying to the military complex, just the cost overruns are over $350 billion a year, which is more than all of the other Western societies and a few non-Western societies spend combined on their military budgets. It is just insane. It's inhumane, and it boggles the mind that we can blow more money than the rest of the world actually spends on their on military armaments. It's just
$3 billion would make the world have fresh, clean, healthy water.
Exactly. Well,
For $10 or $15 billion, could probably feed the whole world. The fact that we're spending, billions of dollars in these wars, and the cost in the end is trillions of dollars, and the is utterly insane and criminal. But
yeah.
This is a dream, and it's a bad dream, and we have to convert it into a good dream, and we have to find our own inner peace. And if we can't do anything about it outwardly, at least we can do something inwardly. And if we can bring ourselves into a state of love and look at our own inner terror and how afraid we have been, you know, made by the government, and I can tell you, they can hurt you real bad. They do hurt you real bad when you go against them. And I did it. I went through it. And I think it was worth it.
Well, I think you came out on the other side very, very well. And as we close out today, this our conversation, again, I want to say how happy and fortunate I am and all of our listeners are to hear from Nick Sand, the legendary Orange Sunshine chemist. But I want you to comment on a conversation I had with Albert Hoffman when my wife and I had the good fortune to visit he and Anita in 2003. We were talking about the medicine, the spiritual value of LSD as a medicine. And I said, on a medicinal level, what would your recommendations be for someone throughout their life as far as taking LSD? And he said that he felt the first experience should be in your 20s, to establish a worldview, to give you opposing view thoughts, opposing views and thoughts. And then he thought in middle age would be the second time. And then in your twilight years to take it a third time and reflect upon how your worldview evolved over those years. What would you say if it was a medicine and that was the only way we could get it? What do you think would be a proper medicinal dose, I guess, and how it should be done?
Well, I think first of all you have to realize that for psychedelics to work, there's a certain threshold level for when they start to really become psychedelic. And with LSD, I think it's 200 to 300 micrograms. With mescaline, it's 400 to 500. The burgeoning use of ayahuasca is, of course, very difficult because of its herbal nature, but it has been very important for curing a lot of people. You know, it seems that the youth, as they hit their adolescence and they're starting to form, if it's not done right, it can be irrelevant to their development. It's just another drug experience. But it does seem to be very important to a lot of teenagers, older teenagers, 15, 16, 17, but even as young as 12, I've met many groups of 12-year-old runaways who took LSD. Did they do it right all the time? No. But was it better than what they ran away from? Yes. So, I mean, in an ideal world, yes, Hoffman's idea is very good. But the reality on the ground is people need to take more trips than 3 trips in their life. Some people will get it on 1 trip. Some people need to take it a lot. I had come from a very difficult childhood, and I needed to take psychedelics. I think I've taken DMT and LSD and mescaline maybe a total of 2,000 times in my life. So would I limit myself to 20, 40, and 60? No, I don't think so. If everything were perfect in the world, that would probably be adequate. But I think it's entirely up to the individual and how far they wanted to go. A lot of the conclusions that Hoffman came to are the same ones I came to. Through years of experience, set and setting, having beautiful lands and temples where people could be entertained by guides and sitters who would take them through their trips and help them, not out of their sickness, but to go from wellness to even more wellness. This whole thing of the medicinal effect of it to cure something that's not right, once that happens, then you can go from there to things that are more brilliant. And after you've done your integration. Now, sometimes if you're too young and you take it, it can scramble you a bit, especially if you're doing it in like a street setting where there's no way you can really find a peaceful place because you don't want to do it at home because you're afraid of your parents drug testing you or whatever. But I think it's important that it's taken early enough for you to develop this worldview and to understand, you know, the value of the psychedelic. On the ground, it happens a lot younger because people in their teens are already seeing that something's not right and something's not satisfying and something's not working and they need information. And that information can be gathered through psychedelics.
Well, you mentioned that you had taken hallucinogens close to several thousand times, and I'll be honest with you, I've never met anybody that's done it that much. My experience is around a couple hundred times, but do you still enjoy psychedelics, or have you moved on into a different plane?
Well, you know, I've just come through experiencing a rare blood disease and having a heart attack and so on. And so right now, basically, all I'm doing is fast walking, yoga, meditation, and pranayama, and I've switched to an entirely vegetarian diet. And I've read a very important book called The China Study by T. Colin Campbell, who was a government nutritionist and has written a book, which I think is very important. And basically it says everything that you can get from a meat-based diet, an animal-based diet, can be gotten way better from a plant-based diet. And he has 500,000 studies to back him up in peer-reviewed journals. So I think we're heading toward vegetarianism. I think we're headed toward meditation. I think we're headed toward self-realization. And there are many tools for doing that. As you get older, you don't need so much anymore. So, and since, of course, I am elderly now, I am a little more limited with all the medicines I'm having to take. So meditation and the remembrance of the state, which has been so thoroughly imprinted on my mind, is carrying me now. And I'm realizing that there's truth, which is the first thing you need to discover. And then when you begin to understand the truth about yourself and everything around you, you can move into love. And that love connects you with all of that. And there's still yet something above love, and that is the direct perception of beauty. And I have just discovered a whole new level of that. And that's that everything around us is imbued with preciousness. And I think if we can keep moving from truth to love to beauty to preciousness, everything around us becomes sacred. And that's what I would like for everyone listening to this to understand. It is your birthright. No one can take it away from you. You are free. You are free forever. Just drop your chains and stop carrying them because someone told you to.
Well, on that, Nick, that I agree with you more than I can state. And on that, I think we're going to end our conversation here today. And I just want to tell you how happy I am for you, for your health getting back together, and for all that you've done over the years to bring LSD and the realization of what that drug can, or what that sacrament, as you say, can mean to an individual's worldview and mental health. I'm just overwhelmed and very, very happy to have had you on the show today. We've got about an hour and a half worth of a conversation, and now we've got it on record for everyone. And again, Nick and Usha, thank you very much for taking the time out of, I know it was a very busy day, to speak with me and all of our listeners. And what I'd like to do, Nick, is just give you the last 30 seconds or whatever long you want to leave what you think everybody should take away from our talk today.
I think I just did it.
I think you did, too.
And if I may say so, I am very heartened by your invitation to speak to many people and to be able to share my truth. And you've given me this opportunity, and I'm very grateful. I find you to be a very nice person, and thank you so much. I recommend to the people that they could listen to this recording numerous times, and they will get more and more out of it as they move along on their own personal journey. Take what they can from the well that I have dug and drink from it and be cleansed and be nourished.
Nick Sand, the most famous 60s chemist for LSD, thank you very much. It's been very enlightening, and we send our love. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I send my love to all of you out there.
All righty. You've been in the opium den, Nick.
Can you send me a CD of this?
You'll be able to actually...
MP3 thing, huh?
Yeah, this will be able to be downloaded from the website, so it's
cool.
Out there for everyone. Again, thank you very much, Nick. We love you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Bye now.
Bye now.